Welcome. Good evening. The middle way. Is not between this and that. Because the middle way is ungraspable. So if it were the middle between, for example, between existence and non-existence, if there were such thing, then it would be some other graspable location. The middle is another location. So actually, in between is another location. So this unlocatable middle is not between anything. So when we talk about the middle way, this is one point to keep in mind. It's the middle that's free from the two extremes. Free from the two extremes, but not really between them. Between doesn't sound that extreme, but in fact, I would say it's a little bit extreme. At least it's some place, whereas the Buddha's middle way is not really some place. Free from the extremes of substantial existence and empty nothingness, non-existence. Another name for the middle way is Buddha nature. Buddha nature is the middle way. Buddha nature, our true nature, the mind's true nature, is empty awareness, or aware emptiness. Right now we're aware. That's how we're experiencing this world and our life. This awareness can't be denied, and yet our usual awareness like this is like aware, this dualistic way where there's seems like there's me aware of you. But Buddha nature is awareness without this sense of split, division, separation between me and you, between subject and object, between mind and phenomena. And it's the nature of our mind already. There isn't really this separation. It's just that our dualistic consciousness that we call a sentient being perceives the world as external. So at the same time that me as a sentient being am living in the world out there and perceiving this separation, at the same time Buddha nature is just clearly aware with no sense of separation. And sometimes we're just settled on Buddha nature without actually knowing it. Generally, if we start to know it, then we're creating a sense of separation anyway. So in Zazen, when deeply settled, letting go of conceptual separation, we might be just settled in or as our Buddha nature. That's free of these extremes of dualistic appearances and free of the extreme of empty nothingness or non-existence. So the third Zen ancestor says, turning the light of awareness around, shining it back on Buddha nature, the big sphere of awareness. Turning the light of awareness around, there's going beyond appearance and emptiness. It's going beyond those two extremes, just being Buddha nature. Asking, who is this? Is turning the light around. So this aware emptiness is free of the extreme of substantial existence, like it's not some Buddha nature, it's not some substantially existent thing, like some essence, some little atom in the center of our heart that we could get a hold of. It's not substantially existing in any way. It's free of that extreme, but it's also free of the extreme of total non-existence, because we're aware. And total non-existence would be like there's no life, nothing is possible. But we're clearly aware there's life, we just can't get a hold of what this is. This life is ungraspable. It's alive, but we can't say what it is. It's kind of like the middle way of Buddha nature. So case 18 in the Book of Serenity is called Jiaozhou's Dog. Especially for Michael, because he likes dogs. Jiaozhou's Dog. You maybe have heard this story before. It's one of the classic Zen stories, but you might not have heard this particular rendition that's, I think, really brings out the middle way. The introduction to this case is a gourd floating on the water. Push it down and it turns. So I think this is like the middle way. It's like a gourd, a hollow gourd floating on the water. If you try to get rid of this middle way or something, or get a hold of it, or just push it straight down, it just pops up one way or the other, rolling around on the water. Like, what's that game? Bobbing for apples? Where you try to catch an apple in your mouth? Or is it a watermelon? What's the one with the slippery watermelons? Isn't there something like a greased watermelon in a swimming pool? And you try to grab it between your toes? I don't think I ever played this game, but I have some vague notion of it. It's like the middle way. You can't get a hold of it. It's very slippery. So a gourd floating on the water. Push it down and it turns. A jewel or diamond in the sunlight. It has no definite color. This is describing the middle way and also describing Buddha nature, because this story is about Buddha nature. A jewel in the sunlight has no definite color. It cannot be attained by mindlessness, nor known by mindfulness. It doesn't fall into those extremes of mindlessness or mindfulness. Immeasurably great people are still turned about in the stream of words. Is there anyone who can escape? This is the introduction to this story. And the middle way is free from basically the concepts and words, existence and non-existence. There isn't really such thing as substantial existence or total non-existence. Actually, those are conceptual constructs. But even so, immeasurably great people are still turned about in the stream of words. How can we escape being like pushed around by affirmation and denial, yes and no, and so on? So this story is about great Chinese Zen ancestor Zhao Zhou, who we celebrate as his spirit of practice because I think he began practice in maybe in his 20s, and he stayed practicing with his teacher till his teacher died when Zhao Zhou was 57. So 37 years or so. And then when his teacher died, he thought, well, now what? That's like my whole practice life has been practicing with his teacher. And I'm getting older, I'm 57, but I actually, this slippery gourd watermelon floating on the water is not, it needs more clarification. So I guess I better go somewhere and inquire more into the way. So he set out on this pilgrimage to go meet as many teachers as he could and practice in as many places as he could. A little unusual to start this when you're 57. But that was his spirit, and when he set out on his pilgrimage, he said, if on my way I meet a six-year-old child who has some wisdom that I haven't yet heard, I'll venerate them and respectfully ask them for the teaching. And if I meet a venerable elder teacher who has something to teach me, who has something to learn still, then I'll teach them something. So that was his spirit. And then he wandered around China until he was 80, and till his legs got too tired of walking around in these different mountains, and said, it's time to stop. And also, I've been practicing for 70 or 80 years. I should probably try to offer something back now. Even though I haven't fully clarified this matter, still, I might as well. I might as well plant myself somewhere and be available. So he started teaching when he was 80, and then he lived to be 120, according to the story. So he still got to teach Zen for 40 more years. So one time, a monk came to Zhao Zhou and asked, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And it may be that there was like the temple dog was actually just sitting next to them and lying there, scraggly temple dog that nobody's bothering to really take care of, gnawing on a bone, drooling, untrained dog. And it may be that this monk just asked about that because he really wants to know about maybe his own Buddha nature, but that's maybe like a little too personal. So does that dog have Buddha nature or not? Does it have it or not have it? Or we could nuance this story a little bit. As Dogen nuanced it, this is a little Chinese lesson. This character, in Japanese, we pronounce "u," means, quite dynamically, it means to have, but it also means to be. So, usually you would read this sentence as, does a dog have Buddha nature? Or the sutras say, all sentient beings have Buddha nature. But Dogen felt like that was left a little room for making Buddha nature into some graspable thing, something that we have. A person has something is a little bit separate from them, right? Sounded a little dualistic to Dogen, so he kind of reinterpreted this grammar, which is legitimate to do, because even though it would usually be read that way, he read it as instead of all beings have Buddha nature, all beings are Buddha nature. It means that too. It's also the character that's used for existence. U is existence and mu is non-existence. So the Chinese is something like dog's Buddha nature, u or mu. Meaning, you see, you could read it as, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Or is a dog Buddha nature or not? Or does a dog's Buddha nature exist or not exist? You could translate it in these different ways. Is a dog actually Buddha nature or not? And Zhao Zhou said, yes. He said, yes. He said, ooh. Or, it exists. Or, it has. Or, it is. And the monk said, well, since it has Buddha nature, why does it enter into this skin bag, drooling and gnawing on a bone like that? If this magnificent, non-dual, wakeful awareness, imbued with the Buddha qualities of great love and compassion, why does it enter into this drooling dog, this magnificent Buddha nature? Why is it in this skin bag? This is a way of talking about this body. And Zhao Zhou, it's a little unusual for him to give kind of like an answer, kind of explain for this monk. So, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Yes, Zhao Zhou says. The monk says, well, since it has, why is it in this skin bag? And Zhao Zhou says, it knowingly and willingly transgresses. The Buddha nature. Another translation is, it knows, yet deliberately transgresses. Buddha nature, part of its definition of this empty awareness, this aware emptiness, with no fixed reference points, yet clearly aware, is like Buddha's awareness. It's true knowing. It's like the Buddha knowing. So Zhao Zhou says, this Buddha nature, it knows, yet deliberately transgresses, which is a way of saying it's willing to like enter into this skin bag called a dog or a person. Or it knowingly and willingly manifests as a dog or a person. So that's what Buddha nature does. And it's not just that it does that in that particular dog, but that's one way of talking about this empty awareness called Buddha nature must manifest as a sentient being. It's not like there's this empty awareness that's like floating around in space, disembodied. it always goes with the body. Kind of like there's no emptiness floating around in space without form. Emptiness itself is form. Buddha nature itself is a sentient being. Knowingly and willingly, kind of like this Buddha wisdom called Buddha nature, knowingly and willingly manifests as all of us. Like, it's not something that's like deciding what to do exactly. It just has to be that way. This is also a way to look at like a bodhisattva vow, is that we bodhisattva vows to keep manifesting as a sentient being. Maybe in the end, if all beings are free from their dualistic hang-ups and everything, then Buddha nature maybe could take some form other than a sentient being. Maybe some possibility like this. But since this doesn't seem likely in the near future, that all delusion in the universe will be eradicated, then the bodhisattva vows to keep coming back as a dog or a human or some way that we can relate to other sentient beings to be of some help. Buddha nature has a hard time relating without a body. So, does a dog have Buddha nature? Or is a dog Buddha nature or not? Yes, it is Buddha nature. Well, since it is, why is it in this skin bag? Well, it knowingly and willingly becomes, manifests as, enters this body, dog body. So then that story started circulating around Zhaozhou's temple, maybe. So another monk wanted to check out Zhaozhou and see what he would say. So he asked the same question. Somebody else came to Zhaozhou and said, "Does a dog have Buddha nature or not?" And Zhaozhou said, "No." "No." In Japanese, "mu." This is the more well-known answer of Zhaozhou. And sometimes that's the whole story. Zhaozhou said, "No," the end. And we just have to contemplate, in the light of these teachings, that all sentient beings have Buddha nature. Why would Zhaozhou say no? But in this version, in the Book of Serenity, Zhaozhou explains again. Zhaozhou said no. And the monk said, "Well, all sentient beings have Buddha nature, as the sutras say. Why does a dog not have it?" And Zhaozhou said, "Because it still has karmic consciousness." All sentient beings are Buddha nature. Why is a dog not Buddha nature? Because the dog is still karmic consciousness. So this karmic consciousness is this, Buddha nature is this non-dual awareness with no sense of self and other. Karmic consciousness is like our usual awareness, that's like a consciousness of objects. Sometimes it's consciousness and awareness are compared. Consciousness is dualistic, and this Buddha awareness is non-dual. And Buddhas no longer do karma. You know karma? Anyone know the definition of karma?
Volitional action?
Yeah, volitional action of body, speech, or mind. And I think it's one of those words like in the English dictionary now, karma. Karma and dharma are probably in the Webster's these days. And hopefully it says something like that. Because I think there's popular notions of karma that are like, almost like good luck or something. Like, yeah, that happened to them because of good karma. That's their good karma, that they won the lottery. So karma is more like the action. We might say it's due to their karma that they won the lottery. But the karma is more like the cause instead of the effect. It's the action that leads to a result. And it's volitional, yeah, volitional or intentional, which kind of means, kind of implies, as I understand it, that there's a sense of like a volitioner, a doer, an intender, a self that's doing something. That's why the Buddha still looks like the Buddha's doing things, but we don't call it karma anymore, because there's not a sense of like I'm doing something. So there is activity that we do too, like our heart beating is not karmic activity because it's not volitional, or it's not like I'm deciding to make my heart beat. But if I like try to practice like relaxing really deeply so my heart slows down or something, then that would be like karmic, intentionally changing the heart rate. So this is what sentient beings have, is karmic consciousness. This translation says, it still has impulsive consciousness. Impulsive. And when Dogen comments on this story, he says, commenting on this line, he says, this having karmic consciousness is existence or being for the sake of others. So again, he puts a bodhisattva twist on it. That, you know, the dog isn't Buddha nature, we could say. The dog isn't itself Buddha nature because it's actually has this karmic consciousness. We could say the true nature of karmic consciousness is Buddha nature. But in this case, Jiao Do is just emphasizing the karmic consciousness part. And Dogen says, this karmic consciousness actually is being for the sake of others, which is a little bit like knowingly and willingly transgressing. So in both cases, what's sort of like, has a sort of a negative flavor to it in this story, we could see, and it's brought out as, this is the bodhisattva's vow to, that's the way we relate also in the realm of karmic consciousness. So is a dog Buddha nature or not? Sometimes Jiao Do says yes, sometimes he says no. And again, these two, yes and no, are u and mu. Sometimes he says existence, sometimes he says non-existence. Or it is, or it isn't. Jiao Do himself is like a gourd. When pushed down on the water, he rolls one way or the other, depending on who knows what. Depending on all the conditions of the moment and the particular person he's talking to. And he's not turned about in the stream of words, pushed around by words. The middle way is free from always being yes or always being no. Another time in the record of Jiao Zhou, a monk asked Jiao Zhou, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? And Jiao Zhou said, The door of every house leads to the capital. A little bit like that. When the monk heard that, that's the song that went that started floating from the clouds. Does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Every door leads to the capital. That's a free from yes and no. Every door is like, sometimes they call the eyes and the ears, the sense doors, that are like entrances, how consciousness experiences the world, and awareness comes through these eyes and ears. The true person of no position, we call Buddha nature, is constantly moving in and out through the doors of our face. So in this kind of poetic answer, does a dog and you and me and all these beings with their senses going through the world, do they have Buddha nature or not? Every door, the door of every house, the door of every house, all of our houses, leads to the capital. The inconceivable, radiant capital. Yeah, that's a kind of a poetic yes answer. I think we could hear it as that, yeah. But we could also hear it as no, because actually, when you the door of the Zendo here opens to Washington D.C., right? Because you go out here and you go on out in the street, and then you like on another street and you take a right and a left, and like after a long time you arrive in Washington D.C. in the capital. But actually, this Zendo is not really in the capital. It's just there's a path from our door to the capital, but it might be like a long path. So in that way, we could say like no. It's not really that the Zendo is the capital, but the door of the Zendo does lead to the capital. So we could hear it as maybe yes or no. And here's an even more obscure story that maybe nobody, I hadn't heard this until I found it in an obscure place. And it's kind of the surprising thing about this is that this story took place 20 years before this story with Jiaozhou, with this other Zen teacher in China, Ikan in Japanese, it may be Gui Guan. And a monk asked Gui Guan, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Amazing, I thought, because this story is so famous for Jiaozhou talking about the dog's Buddha nature. But somebody else asked the same question about a dog 20 years earlier, but it never really, like, it never made it into the koan collections. A monk asked Gui Guan, does a dog have Buddha nature or not? Gui Guan said, yes. The monk said, do you, teacher, have Buddha nature or not? And Gui Guan said, no. And the monk said, well, all sentient beings have Buddha nature. Why don't you? And Gui Guan said, because I'm not a sentient being. The monk said, well, if you're not a sentient being, then are you a Buddha or not? Gui Guan said, no, I'm not a Buddha. The monk said, then what kind of thing are you? If you're not a sentient being or a Buddha. And Gui Guan said, I'm not a thing either. And now the monk's just like, well, whatever you are, can it be seen and known? I mean, what's going on here? And Gui Guan said, it can't be thought of or known. It's completely unknowable. The middle way. cannot be thought of or known. It's completely unknowable. So, in the commentary here, it says, if you say a dog's Buddha nature exists afterwards, he said no. If it surely does not exist, still previously he said yes. And if you say that to say yes or no is just a temporary response spoken according to the situation, in each case there's some reason he gives. That's why it's said that someone with clear eyes has no nest. He's not nesting. Nesting is like a kind of a Zen word for like the comfy place where you can kind of like, you understand what's going on and you can kind of like camp out there. But like in either yes or no. But someone with clear eyes has no nest. In the Bible it says, the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Like same idea. So I would say no nest is the middle way. And Tenshin Roshi, commenting on this commentary, says, actually, you cannot get out of your nest. If you're in a nest of yes or no, you can only realize that there isn't a nest. You can't get out of it. Just have to realize that the nest is not what we think. It's not really a nest. Luckily, otherwise we'd have to like start unweaving all these little straws and we'd get all kind of like cut up by little branches and stuff. So the verse celebrating this story of Jiaozhou's dog says by Tiantong Hongzhir, a dog's Buddha nature exists. A dog's Buddha nature does not exist. A straight hook basically seeks fish who turn away from life. Guess what a straight hook is? Any guesses?
Zazen.
Zazen! That's right. Any other ways to say it?
A spear.
Any other ways? The middle way. Straight hook. Other like hooks curve either this way, extremely curve around this way, or they extremely curve around this way. So a straight hook doesn't fall into either extreme. It's the middle way. But the straight hook basically seeks fish who turn away from life, or fish who let go of body and mind. They just fall onto a straight hook. You said a spear, right? So actually as these verses often come from old sayings, so there's some old saying that says, a straight harpoon or spear catches ferocious dragons, a curved hook catches clams. So, Jiaozhou's being willing to say yes or no is a little bit like a straight hook. Chasing the air, pursuing fragrance, cloud and water monks, in noisy confusion, make excuses and explanations. So, when they're debating, but when I asked Jiaozhou, he said yes. So I don't know when he said no, and this is how he explained it. And like, so this is the right answer. You're wrong. No, you're wrong. I'm right, because he didn't say no, he said yes. He said yes, he didn't say no. I mean, you're wrong. chasing the air, pursuing fragrance, cloud and water travelers, named for Unsui is the name for traveling monks. In noisy confusion, they make excuses and explanations, trying to figure out this issue of Buddha nature. Making an even presentation, Jiaozhou throws the shop wide open. An even presentation is kind of like the middle way. Don't blame him for not being careful in the beginning. Pointing out the flaw, he takes away the jewel. The king of Qin didn't know Lian Xiangru. So, as is often the case, just referring to these old Chinese stories. And this is just kind of a nice story, I thought. I think it comes up in other Zen koans too. So just so you know, some old, it's not really Zen, but it's just, you know, well-known Chinese stories in this old days. So there was this amazing jewel, this like diamond-like jewel that like was more beautiful than we can imagine, and like naturally so. it as the introduction, like a jewel in the sunlight, no definite color. So King Hui of Zhao got this special jewel of the Ho clan and offered it to King Zhao in exchange for 15 cities. So, like, this is a political maneuver. I have this amazing jewel, but actually all these cities on the border between our countries, I'd like to trade you this jewel for 15 cities, and it's a good deal for you, because this jewel is amazing. Lian Xiangru was like the minister for this king who conveyed the offered jewel to the other king. And the king of Qin, who was being offered to, joyfully showed the jewel in turn to his concubines and attendants, and everyone around him cried, "Long live the king!" And they were all celebrating, "Isn't this an amazing jewel?" And Xiangru, the minister delivering it, saw that the king had no intention of ceding his cities. He was just becoming kind of like arrogant about how amazing this jewel was, and he wasn't even like talking about how he was gonna. This is a trade for the cities here. So this minister came forward and said, "Actually, this jewel that you're just ranting and raving about, actually it has a little flaw. Let me show you." And we could say the meaning is maybe like, "You, king, have a little flaw. You're being a little bit arrogant about this jewel." So the minister took the jewel and he put it between his head and the pillar they were standing next to. He butted his head with it against the pillar, leaning against it, and said, "The king of Zhao, my king, fasted for 5 days before he bade me, his minister, to present this jewel and deliver his letter to the court, adorning the majesty of your great nation to practice respect. Now I see your majesty's manners are quite haughty. When you got the jewel, you just turned it over to show your attendants here as though making sport of me, with no intention of ceding the cities. Therefore, I've taken the jewel back. If you try to press me, my head and the jewel will both smash on this pillar." Can you picture the scene? He's kind of holding the jewel like this. "If you try to like grab me and execute me for this kind of radical action to the great king, the jewel is going to drop on the stone floor and smash. And smash my head too." So the king actually like kind of got it and apologized. And he drew a map and partitioned off the 15 cities. And he also fasted for 5 days, kind of in respect for this jewel. And then You'd think that would be a good ending of the story, but actually, Shangru, the minister, was not quite satisfied, so he had one of his company hide the jewel in his sleeve and head right back to his King Zhao. So, even though the king apologized and everything, he said, "You're still maybe not worthy of this jewel." So he took it back. So the commentary says, "Zhao Zhou first gives, then takes away. He had the technique of Shangru." So, in other words, we could see, first, does a dog have Buddha nature? Do I have Buddha nature? Yes. How great. That's what we all want to hear, right? But then we can become kind of like, we can get too carried away in the celebration of this precious jewel, Buddha nature, and kind of arrogant, maybe. Everything's Buddha nature. How can we ever go wrong? And then, maybe that's what happened, too. The monk said, "Yeah, Zhao Zhou says a dog has Buddha nature, so let's all just lie around drooling and gnawing bones, since that's Buddha nature." And then, so then Zhao Zhou said to the next person who asked, "No, actually, no, there's still this issue of karmic consciousness. Every door leads to the capital, but it's a long road to Washington." So the verse, pointing out the flaw, he takes away the jewel. The king of Qin didn't know Lian Shangru, the minister. Yes, Richard.
How is it possible to take karmic consciousness out of Buddha nature? How can that exist outside Buddha nature? Karmic consciousness.
Yeah, so I think this is why we don't fall into yes or no. And so one way that I have been considering this, that kind of question, is, and this is just conceptual constructions. We're playing with this, you know, words about Buddha nature here. But I'm kind of seeing it as like Buddha nature manifests karmic consciousness. Karmic consciousness must be part of Buddha nature. Everything must be, right? So Buddha nature manifests karmic consciousness, but then the karmic consciousness blocks the Buddha nature. And this is like amazing. I think this is amazing. We could say wisdom manifests delusion, and then delusion obscures the wisdom. Delusion actually is part of the wisdom, but it functions for us as sentient beings to obscure. That's why we like seem to suffer sometimes. We have problems. When we're falling into the reified dualistic world, me and my little life, and me and my problems, right, is me and my problems are manifestations of Buddha nature, but they are what obscure the clear view of Buddha nature at the same time. So what would that be? Like almost like
a thought?
Yeah, like a thought. Yeah, a thought emerges from Buddha nature. Amazingly, this nature of mind gives rise to a thought, and then the thought obscures it, but in fact, the thought is itself Buddha nature. So we have another Zen story that's like, where this monk quotes the Flower Ornament Sutra, or some commentary where it says, "The fundamental affliction of ignorance is itself the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas. The fundamental affliction of ignorance is itself the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas. And, but like, how can we understand this? He asks his teacher, and the teacher says, I'll show you. And there's a novice monk walking by as they're speaking, and he says, hey, you! And the novice turns his head, yeah? And the teacher says, is that not the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas? In other words, just spontaneous response, no conceptual thinking, no figuring, no self-consciousness. Yes? Just cause and effect, purely radiant, right? And is that not the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas? And then he turns to his friend and says, or he turns to the novice and says, what is Buddha nature? And the novice goes, I don't know, I gotta go now. And gets all flustered because the teacher's asking him this awesome question that he thinks he should know the answer to. And he kind of runs away. And the teacher says, is that not the fundamental affliction of ignorance? And the same person, moment to moment, is like, that fundamental affliction of ignorance is a manifestation of the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas. And yet, it's like that when the monk was questioned like that, he got all confused. Maybe when he heard this saying from the sutra that his ignorance is itself perfect Buddha mind, then maybe he could say, oh, then it's okay if I'm all confused. This may be another question. Is it okay? Is it okay? A monk asked Zhaozhou, is it okay if the dog hasn't realized his Buddha nature? Yeah, it's okay, actually. And then another monk asked Zhaozhou, is it okay if the dog hasn't realized its Buddha nature? No, it's actually not okay. It's going to suffer until it realizes. So, it's these two sides. Yes.
One another way to look at it is to look at all our suffering and afflictions that cause us to look for a way through them.
Yeah.
And that's the reason for all religions is to how do we deal with the suffering and the karmic conditions that we have and create for ourselves.
But that's a nice point. As I understood what you said, it's like you could say the reason we have these karmic afflictions is that they spur us forward to see through them to practice and realize what they really are.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is empty.
Yeah, which is empty. So you could say, that's why, this would be one story we could tell, that's why Buddha nature, people often ask this when we say, we're talking about how everything's empty. Well then why are if our true nature is this non-dual awareness, why do we have this dualistic consciousness to perceive the world? And you could say, well, partly it's so that we can have a world. And, but you could, we'd say, why have a world? And I think your answer is like, how Buddha nature makes a world in order to kind of like, almost like play this game, right? Of like, the world then has this opportunity to like, realize that it's not a world. You could say, and why? Well, so much fun. or why not? That'd be another one.
And
why not?
It's beyond words. It's more in just, yes, responding to the situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Without thinking it over, just be really being clear and open.
Like Suzuki Roshi says, it's wisdom that's seeking wisdom.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, if it's seeking wisdom, it means it's lacking something that it needs, but actually this confused person that's seeking wisdom, actually it's wisdom.
Yeah.
that's seeking wisdom. Yeah.
Finding the wisdom that we all have in us.
Yeah. And we're naturally drawn to that, yes.
Is there a reason why the dog is used? Does the dog have Buddha nature? Is it because the lowliness of the dog?
I think that might be, like as I said, you know, maybe it was... My made-up story is maybe the monk was talking to Jiajiu and was really concerned with his own Buddha nature, but because that was so personal, he said, does that dog over there, or does that person over there have Buddha nature? But maybe it's, yeah, I think part of the implication, I would guess, is also that the dog seems like, I mean, dogs are wonderful, right? But we might say, well, does this dog really have the skillful means to awaken all beings to their Buddha nature? And dog lovers might say, yeah, it has more skillful means than people. But I think in the tradition it might be like, yeah, you know, the dog has more karmic hindrances to work through than humans. And we can argue this, but I think that's probably the implication is, but you could use anything. You could use person, I think, or mouse. Yes.
I think actually the dog in Japanese culture during that period is considered a really low class. So, for example, during the kind of in the period right after Dogen, the untouchable class.
Ah.
English translation for what the Japanese call them is basically dog.
Huh.
So, and they were the class of people who butchered animals.
Hmm.
Oh.
So
interesting.
I don't think the dog was with the bone drooling. Or maybe it was, but...
Yeah, know, maybe both are implied.
Considered...
Well, that's...
It's almost derogatory.
Yeah. And that kind of sheds light on it. It's kind of saying, do all classes and castes have Buddha nature? Which, of course, is part of the wonderful implication, is that equally, yeah, they all sentient beings equally share Buddha nature. It's just that in terms of fleas and humans and all, some may be more obscured. The obscurations that are a manifestation of Buddha nature might be greater in some beings than others. But the Buddha nature is exactly identical. And the obscurations being Buddha nature is also identical. So that's an interesting point. And I think that it's some old Chinese character they use for dog, because when Dogen comments on it, he uses that character and he says, this character means dog, he writes in hiragana, as if people didn't know that was an unusual Chinese term or something. And I've also heard that the term, that particular term for dog, means like puppy or little dog. And so maybe part of this thing about like karmic consciousness is that little puppy dogs are like really just like out of control. Like there's the noble golden retriever, something like that, you know, it's like totally loyal. But the little tiny puppy may be just like totally like wacko, running all over the place and pooping all over the place. And does that have Buddha nature? Yes.
You know what it makes me think of? What? Whatever poet said, the point where you start, your death, your journey is over, is where you'll return to. I forget who that would have been. I don't know who it was.
T.S. Eliot.
We shall never cease from exploring, and the end of all our exploring will be to return to where we started and know the place for the first time.
Right.
Okay. Is that T.S. Eliot?
That poem?
That's from the Four Quartets. I'm not sure. I can't remember which one.
I've heard that's a good poem.
Yeah, but it's from the last East Coker, I think, but I'm not sure. I grew up back there, so...
Yeah, so the relationship between the sentient being and the Buddha nature is very, very interesting.
Yeah.
And are they the same or not? There's another question. Yes, they're the same. No, they're not the same. It doesn't fall into either of those extremes.
But you're still trying to pin down the words that you can't.
The relationship between sentient being and Buddha nature is the middle way. So any like positive virtues and merits gathered from our practice intentions and wholehearted efforts to realize the way to benefit all beings, may all of it be packaged into a big ball of love and dedicated to all beings. May they all realize their Buddha nature. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to become it.